My guest today, a return visit to Takes on the World, is investigative reporter Bob Perry from that excellent news source for these troubling times, Consortium News. He broke many of the Iran-Contra stories for the Associated Press and Newsweek in the 1980s. In his latest book, America's Stolen Narrative, a trilogy on the Bush family and its connections to various right-wing operatives, is available online from Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Welcome once again, Bob Perry, to Takes on the World.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. You've been closely following the U.S. media's coverage of the ongoing war in Syria and Iraq and the difference in the way the Syrian government's efforts to retake Aleppo from al-Qaeda-backed fighters, jihadists, compares with how the U.S. media is treating the U.S.-backed offensive in Mosul to take that back from ISIL. And you wrote an article which aptly describes your position on good deaths in Mosul, bad deaths in Aleppo. Tell us about it.
Well, basically, we've often seen this pattern where comparable situations are treated very differently by the American press, that in part because the American, the mainstream media has become heavily dependent upon some of the activists, some of them being jihadists inside places like East Aleppo, and that's where they get much of their information. So they tend to report in a fairly sympathetic way toward those jihadists. But in the meantime, on something like we're in Mosul in Iraq, where you have the U.S.-backed forces attacking a city that has 1.2 million people, but is under the control of the Islamic State, that's treated in a very different way. We hear, for instance, in the latter, we'll hear a lot about human shields, which is a sort of a common situation when the U.S. is attacking a city. You go back to Fallujah in 2004 in Iraq, or say a U.S. ally, for instance, Israel attacking Gaza repeatedly and over the years. Then there's always this talk about the reason there are civilian casualties is because these evil forces are using human shields. But in the case of East Aleppo, the human shield issue is gone. Plus, there's been a real hesitancy, even a refusal in many cases, for the U.S. media to discuss the role of al-Qaeda in East Aleppo. The focus is always on supposedly moderate rebels, even though it's now clear, and actually has been reported by a few of these news outlets, like the Wall Street Journal, that the so-called moderate rebels in East Aleppo have clearly openly allied themselves with al-Qaeda. They're essentially fighting under the command of al-Qaeda, which is called the Nusra Front, and they've rebranded themselves recently as the Syria Conquest Front. But still, you're talking about jihadists, extremists, in both cases, inside East Aleppo and inside Mosul. But the way the American press deals with those two very comparable issues, where civilians are going to die as these places are attacked, and there's an effort to get rid of these terrorist elements, they're reported in very dramatically different ways.
Well, your latest article, which just came out on the 29th, Saturday, the de facto U.S. al-Qaeda alliance points out to the fact, a rare mention in the New York Times, that this is the case. That usually they kind of fudge around it and talk about moderates, but you refer to the two journalists for the New York Times based in Beirut who have actually understood the situation and are reporting it as you had mentioned in the past, that this is largely a fight led by an al-Qaeda operation franchise that keeps changing its name. The United States has kind of, quote-unquote, urged the so-called moderates to break away from that, just like they've urged Turkey not to let ISIL fighters in to fight in Syria through the Turkish border. But the United States seems unwilling to actually clamp down and on this issue and take a strong position on it.
Well, right. Secretary of State Kerry did call upon the so-called moderate rebels to separate themselves from al-Qaeda. in Aleppo, East Aleppo, where Al Qaeda has this strong base, and they refused. These groups have basically refused. Now, as the Al Qaeda forces are mounting an offensive against the government troops around East Aleppo, the American armed and funded and to some degree trained forces are acting as support units for Al Qaeda. They're using American weaponry to fire rockets into civilian areas of West Aleppo. So in other words, the failure of the American press to report on this in an even-handed, objective way has been striking and has really influenced, I think, how the American public see these two conflicts. Not that there are good guys and bad guys clearly demarcated on either side of these conflicts, but you know, there needs to be more of an objectivity. This idea of pretending that there are only moderate rebels in East Aleppo is false. And the New York Times, and this article ran on page A9, deep inside the paper, very much buried this element that these U.S. supported armed rebels were firing in support of an offensive being carried out by Al Qaeda. So we have this very curious situation where the United States, which entered this whole era of fighting in the Middle East, supposedly as retaliation, revenge, really, for the 9/11 attacks carried out by Al Qaeda, the United States now finds itself in a de facto alliance with Al Qaeda, in Syria at least, unwilling to accept that the so-called moderate rebels who will not separate themselves from Al Qaeda are not deserving of American weapons and support. And many of these groups have served really as cutouts. They present themselves in a more favorable way. They pretend to be moderates. They get weapons from the United States, and they turn them over to Al Qaeda. So Al Qaeda can use them. Or there's another group called Arar el-Sham, which supposedly is not Al Qaeda, but it fights hand in glove with Al Qaeda. It's another one of the powerful rebel forces. It's supported by Saudi Arabia and Qatar and some other Persian Gulf states. But you have this mix of groups, but they're essentially under the command, fighting alongside Al Qaeda. And so instead of dealing with that in a forthright way, the New York Times, when it finally, I guess, felt it had no choice but to mention this, buries it. You might think this would be a front page story. The United States has found itself talking about even intervening militarily more directly in Syria. Former Secretary of State Clinton has said she wants a no-fly zone over Syria, and she's acknowledged that that would mean killing a great number of Syrians and involving a substantial American military force to do this, because it would require destroying the anti-aircraft facilities of the Syrian government. It would mean grounding their air force, destroying their air force, and maybe even shooting down Russian planes, because the Russians are working alongside the Syrian government in going after Al Qaeda and to a degree the Islamic State. So you have the United States even talking about setting up situations so the government of Syria cannot adequately combat Al Qaeda. And that gets into the larger problem of the failure, repeated failure in Washington to think these things through. We saw this in Iraq, for instance, in 2003, the idea, well, the U.S. would invade, just get rid of Saddam Hussein, and then put in some leader like a Chalabi, who was the favorite of the neocons in Washington. But things get more complicated than that. Things spin out of control, and before you know it, you had a full-fledged guerrilla war that the United States had to be fighting. And even to this day, you have a mess, complete mess in Iraq. Similarly in Libya, get rid of Gaddafi was the plan. But, you know, they didn't think about what happens after Gaddafi's gone. And now you have a failed state in Libya where you have competing governments. And people who used to have a pretty high standard of living for Africa now having lost much of that. So you have suffering and killing that's brought about by the chaos that has been spread. And again, there's this failure to think this stuff through as to, okay, what happens if you get rid of the Assad government in Syria? What if, who's going to replace it? And the fact is that the most powerful forces, and that in effect the United States has been at least indirectly collaborating with, involve al-Qaeda. So you could very easily have an al-Qaeda regime in Syria as replacing the Assad regime, or you might have the Islamic State or some combination of the two. Remember, the Islamic State is really a spin-off of al-Qaeda. It was sort of al-Qaeda in Iraq before it expanded into Syria and became the Islamic State. So those are the kinds of things that, that official Washington continuously fails to recognize, and that is aided and abetted by a news media that tries to present these stories in very simplistic good guy, bad guy ways. And there, so you have the bad guy like Assad, and you have the good guys like the so-called moderate rebels in East Aleppo. But we now know, even the New York Times has acknowledged, that these folks are fighting in a support role under the, essentially under the command of al-Qaeda.
Well, it's interesting. It takes us back to 1979, to the war in Afghanistan to get the Russians out of Afghanistan, and Dan Rather dressing up as a Mujahideen, and President Reagan comparing the Mujahideen, which went on to become al-Qaeda, with our freedom fighters. There seems to be no lessons learned from our interventions in that part of the world.
That is another good example of Afghanistan in the 1980s. You had a leftist government in Kabul, and you can fault their economic models if you'd like, but they had freedom for women. You had women in Kabul, Afghanistan, wearing miniskirts. They were given freedom to behave as they wished. They were involved in education and every other aspect of social life. And the Americans felt, it actually begins a bit under President Carter, but then is expanded dramatically under President Reagan, collaborating with the Saudis, which was to fund, to the tune of about $1 billion a year, $500 million from the U.S., $500 million from the Saudis, to support these Islamic fundamentalists. Because what happened in Afghanistan was that some of these religious fundamentalists didn't like the fact that women were wearing miniskirts. They wanted them in full chador. They wanted them fully covered. And so part of their reaction was to sort of bring women back into the Stone Age. And the United States massively supported that as an effort supposedly to undermine the Soviet Union then. And that was the goal. And the CIA was actually printing Korans because they were trying to use Islamic fundamentalism as a way to go after the soft underbelly of the Soviet Union, what's now Kazakhstan and the various Stan states, which were then part of the Soviet Union. So there was an effort to exploit Islamic fundamentalism as a way to undermine atheistic communism. Now, that was considered really a brilliant strategy, and even though the U.S. government knew that these Mujahideen were torturers and they murdered captured Russian soldiers, often would rape them repeatedly before killing them. These were known to be really monstrous guys, although they were portrayed even in American films like Charlie Wilson's War with Tom Hanks. They were portrayed in these very noble propagandistic lights. But they became the core of what we now know as the Taliban, and ultimately, because the Saudis brought in a bunch of international forces, these Islamic extremists, led by Osama bin Laden. So Osama bin Laden is put in business. Ultimately, al-Qaeda is formed out of that. And then it develops its own hatred of the Americans for other reasons. But, again, these things aren't thought through. Yes, it was probably a cool way to sort of give the Russians a bloody nose and help give them their Vietnam, or all the ways people talked about this back in the 1980s. But the consequences of that, the United States helped create the modern jihadist movement, and that has expanded And after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, it expanded even further. And now the United States is still taking actions, often trying to overthrow these secular dictators or authoritarian governments, but they're often replaced by these extremist Islamic dictatorships, which treat women particularly horribly, but then engage in extermination campaigns against the so-called apostates, the Shiites or the Alawites or the Christians. So, you know, the idea that this is this stuff is never thought through. I mean, people often in Washington react, and President Obama has talked about this. He sort of complained about the so-called Washington playbook, which is whenever there's some kind of crisis like this, the go-to play is to send in the U.S. military and knock somebody out, you know, get rid of this guy, do a regime change. But never, it seems, does anyone anticipate that they may be making things worse?
Well, certainly the taking out of Gaddafi in Libya, who at the time that happened was collaborating with the CIA in his retention program. There were people, left hand and right hand were doing different things, although I don't know about left hands in government, right hands are further right hands. But that Libya overthrow released incredible amount of weapons that not only flew, that went into Syria, but also into Africa to arm Boko Haram. I mean, Libya was like a disease that spread. And, of course, Hillary Clinton takes no responsibility for what happened afterward.
Well, she was certainly one of the architects of the Libya fiasco. And I know the Republicans have tried to focus on the Benghazi incident on September 11th, 2012. But they sort of are focusing on the tree and missing the forest. The forest
exactly.
Is that Gaddafi, for all his faults, was maintaining some semblance of a good governance in Libya, where people were getting money for education, getting their health care. Obviously, there was a good deal of oil wealth. He was also sharing some of that wealth with some of the poorer African countries. He had these grandiose visions of himself being a leader of Africa. We now know, based on some of the emails that have come out regarding to Secretary Clinton, that her people at the State Department thought this would be a crowning achievement. They were even talking about a so-called Clinton doctrine, where her use of so-called smart power, that is, without sending in large numbers of American troops on the ground, but using air power and blowing things up and then using various rebel forces on the ground and using economic sanctioning and things of that sort, could create an outcome. And so that's what was applied. But again, this was, as President Obama has said, he has said this, he considered the outcome in Libya the worst foreign policy mistake of his presidency, because there was no real serious or realistic plan of what you do after you kill Gaddafi. And Secretary Clinton was very happy about killing Gaddafi, even though it was rather brutal. He was tortured first before being executed. But she said, famously on this film clip for a news organization, she said, "We came, we saw, he died."
And burst out laughing.
And then sort of laughed and applauded herself.
Yes.
And so but what followed was a real disaster. And we also know that she was told by one of her outside advisors, Sid Blumenthal, that the real goal the French had in terms of why they wanted to see Gaddafi overthrown wasn't that they were trying to make it a better life for the Libyan people. They were concerned that they wanted, first of all, more control of the oil. They wanted to get better oil deals. They were afraid that Gaddafi who was building up a gold reserve, that he was going to use that to create an African currency. And the French wanted to maintain their dominance of their former colonies in France, in Africa, the Francophone colonies, and keep them dependent on the French franc. So there were these kind of fiduciary, economic, financial concerns, not some human rights issue. And so while it was sold to the American people as, oh, we have to save the innocent civilians in around Benghazi, because Gaddafi was saying he was trying to go after these terrorist groups, which were trying to take control in eastern Libya, that was mocked. He was accused of being a genocidal dictator, even though he had no intention. We now know, based on the British Parliament put out a report a few months back saying that all this stuff was untrue, that all the propaganda that the American public was fed during that time was untrue, that there was no effort to slaughter all the civilians in eastern Libya. It was just an excuse that was created to justify what was, first of all, just going to be a safe zone, or it's going to be a no-fly zone to protect those civilians, and very quickly morphed into a regime change operation, which was always intended to go after Gaddafi and kill him. And the results not only were harmful because the American interests, including the death of the ambassador and three other Americans in Benghazi, turned out that Gaddafi was right. There were terrorists operating around Benghazi. But we now have three different competing governments in Libya, one that the UN's tried to impose, which can't even locate itself in Libya because the other two governments don't want it. And so the so-called Government of National Accord, which is usually called the Unity Government, which I think is rather, it's sort of aspirational, let's say, but it's they don't even operate inside Libya. They sit off in Tunis or in some hotels in other parts of Africa and even Europe, while these other governments sort of try to manage things on the ground. And so it's a complete failed state, and people are suffering because the money's not coming in from the oil production is off. Anyway, so you have again a place where conflict and death and destruction have followed these supposedly well-meaning American efforts to intervene, which we now know were driven not just by what they sold us as the reasons, but there are other more geopolitical, realpolitik reasons as well.
My guest is Bob Perry, right from Consortium News, and we're talking about the news coverage of Syria. In your most recent article, you talk about the uses of Western propaganda. Now, we know that in every war, and when people get bombed, people get killed, and no government yet formed has really any concern for human life at the top of its agenda. But we seem to be seeing a piling on of propaganda with this group called the White Helmets, as if this is some kind of heroes coming in to save the people. Could you talk about the use of propaganda, the Western media that's going on in Syria?
Well, we've seen propaganda as the basis for much of these U.S. interventions around the world, which have ended up so disastrously for basically everybody concerned. There's not an effort to really inform the American people, honestly. If you go back, you go back quite a ways, but let's go back to the Iraq War, where the American people were sold a completely false bill of goods, that there were these weapons of mass destruction, that Saddam had reconstituted his nuclear weapons program, that he had all these caches of biological and chemical weapons that he was going to somehow spray on us. It was all false. And though they also had relations with Al-Qaeda, was going to give Al-Qaeda these things when he was the enemy of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda hated him, and he hated them. So we were sold that bill of goods, and of course, 4,500 American soldiers died along with hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, and chaos was spread across the region. But nothing seems to get learned. I mean, or maybe the government, U.S. government, did learn that they could just dupe the American people repeatedly. And they have the American press, which has gone along with this, not doing its job properly, unless you consider its job to be to disinform the American people. Many of the journalists who got Iraq completely wrong are still the same journalists today telling us about what to do in Ukraine or Syria or other places. I mean, literally the same people in many cases. They had no punishment for being completely wrong about Iraq. At the case of the Washington Post, the editorial page editor, Fred Hyatt, wrote as flat fact in 2002 and 2003 repeatedly that Saddam was hiding weapons of mass destruction. After Colin Powell's deceptive speech on February 5th, 2003, before the United Nations, virtually the entire Washington Post editorial page, from its editorial through its op-eds, a solid phalanx of people saying, now there can be no doubt. Anyone who disagrees that Saddam as his WMD is a Saddam apologist. And so they mocked and ridiculed people who were trying to warn the public about the reality. So those of us who were questioning that were shut down. But so you might thought, okay, after this was all discovered, was Fred Hyatt fired? Was he barred from journalism for the harm he did? No, he's still the editorial page editor of the Washington Post. And he's still writing the same kind of nonsense. Now it's about Russia, and it's about Ukraine, and it's about Syria, and so forth, that he did back then. So we've ended up with a situation of dysfunction in Washington, in part because not only does the government use these sort of propagandistic tactics to get us all riled up about some humanitarian thing, which, not to say that there isn't real damage done. People are killed in these conflicts, and there are children killed, and that's true in Gaza. It's true in Syria. It's true in all these conflicts, all these horrible conflicts. And it was true in Iraq when the United States did its shock and awe operation. There were children who were slaughtered in that, and one little kid had his hands blown off, and his parents had both been killed, and his sisters had been killed. And he was then, we sort of acted like we were such humanitarians. We took him to Kuwait to have some false hands put on him. And he said, I'd rather die than live this way. But so we did these things. And we justify it. We blame it on Saddam Hussein. We blame it on somebody. But, you know, but then we also then whip up people about these situation in Syria where, yes, terrible things have happened. But part of that is because the West and Saudi Arabia and other countries have been funneling weapons into Al-Qaeda's operation inside Syria. So when the government tries to attack or, you know, battle back against these groups, we then focus on the human collateral damage, and it's horrible. But in some cases, it also appears that some of these things have been staged, some of these tear-jerking scenes that were shown, because there aren't like Western photographers and journalists inside the rebel areas in Syria. The last ones who did go in were not only arrested or captured, but they were decapitated, if you remember, by Islamic State and other of these radical groups. So you do have this. So you're dependent upon some of these rebel groups to provide the photographs or provide the material that then the U.S. press distributes around the world. So you're sort of captured by, well, is that really true or not? Some of it is just propaganda, and some of it's real, because obviously horrible things happen in war. But so we've been caught up in this game of being manipulated so many times that I don't want to sound cynical, but I'm not sure what you can believe when you see some of these scenes and when you're told some of these stories, especially when the U.S. press corps tries to white out the fact that Al Qaeda is indeed a major player in what's going on in Syria. It's not just the Islamic State. We always hear about these people talking about Islamic State. Well, that's true. They are there, and they are a terrible problem. But it's also Al Qaeda, and unless we've decided that Al Qaeda has become moderate, I don't quite understand why that's happening, except that it kind of confuses the narrative. The desired narrative is we have good guys, the rebels, and bad guys, the government. And so I think instead of that kind of white hat, black hat thing, we should be looking at this much more realistically, that it's a much more mixed bag, and we need to sort of act more in a more mature, honest way about these stories.
Well, we have a media here that's very unusual for, let's say, an advanced country. I mean, you don't have in Italy or France or Germany or UK the kind of AM radio that we have in this country. You have newspapers that actually will publish what's actually going on in Syria or Iraq or Afghanistan, where it seems the Taliban are now more it's becoming, I won't compare the Taliban to Vietnamese, but Vietnam and Afghanistan are becoming very much the same, and the Taliban has more territory now than almost ever before, at least since the 2001 attack. I don't say, and we have an election in which has been the focus of the news media, hour in and hour out. What you're talking about is not discussed. I mean, what's going on with the United States, its footprint in the world, is simply not being discussed either on NPR or the mainstream media, which is focused on whether, I think Hillary Clinton's emails are not insignificant, but they don't even talk about the contents of the WikiLeaks. They try to blame Russia and Julian Assange and WikiLeaks for tampering in the U.S. elections when actually they exposed the Democratic National Committee's tampering with the Democratic Party balloting. It seems like Alice in Wonderland, and then we need a Jonathan Swift or Lewis Carroll to come around and make characters, a novel out of this crazy situation. What do you think is, we have a few minutes left. We have Trump versus Clinton. She is actually supported by the neocons who brought us the war in Iraq. And interesting, just the other day, the New York Times actually reported in an article about General Michael Flynn, former head of the Defense Intelligence Agency's support for Donald Trump, that the neocons, it said the neocons brought the pushed the U.S. into war in Iraq, and it said that in a New York Times article. It was kind of mind-blowing, because a number of us have been saying that for a long time, but those neocons are, in fact, supporting Hillary Clinton.
Well, that's basically correct. But, you know, I don't know really what to say about the campaign. It is a case of, I think, you have two extremely problematic candidates. And I've actually never in my life seen it this difficult to pick, to even think about choosing. Of course, as a journalist, I don't talk about who I vote for.
Right.
I don't try to influence people to vote a certain way. I try to give them information that maybe helps inform them. But going back to the point you made about the press not often talking about these things in terms of these foreign policy matters, it's almost worse when they do. Because when they do, they get it all wrong. They're operating from they read the New York Times, and you can't just blame the AM radio folks, although they deserve their blame too. But you're talking about the New York Times and the Washington Post. You're talking about some of the premier newspapers of the United States getting all this stuff wrong, and they've been getting it wrong not just once or twice, but repeatedly. They just almost like they can't get anything right at this stage because they're so caught up in being, they're almost more interested in being propagandists and sort of steering the public in a certain way. When I was at Newsweek, there was I once had this discussion with a senior editor saying our job should be to inform the public. He said, no, you don't understand. Our job is to guide the public. And I never believed that. I always disagreed with that. But there was this elitist quality that you find in some of these major news organizations, that their job is to sort of, they know what's best, and so what they really are trying to do is not inform you and empower you. They're trying to manipulate you to get you to do what they've decided you ought to do in the first place, support the war in Iraq, for instance, or you know, whatever. I mean, there are all these different things they want us to do. So the media has sort of lost its way, in my view, from what, I'm not saying it was ever a golden era or perfect, but there was more of a commitment when I got into this business back in the 1970s, to the idea was that the people were the sovereigns of the United States, and they needed to be given as much good information as possible to avoid, at that point, another Vietnam War or something like it. They needed to be told the truth, not manipulated with Gulf of Tonkin nonsense. But I'm afraid that over the years, that has sort of been washed away, and we're increasingly being manipulated, not being told the full story or even a halfway honest story. And that does not just apply to some of these bottom feeders like the AM radio folks, but it applies to the New York Times and the Washington Post and the people that are NPR and the folks who are considered the elite media. So I'm not sure what to tell people.
Bob, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. Another informative broadcast. You can read Bob Parry's writings and those of his colleagues on Consortium News. It is one of the very best sources of what's really going on in the world. The New York Times, read the New York Times, then you read consortiumnews.org, right? Yeah.
.com.
And every day there are articles going up, all of them informative, well-selected, fact-backed, and we'll have you back again with some more fact to back up what's going on. We're in for a long, difficult ride. So, Bob Parry, thanks again for being our guest on Takes on the World. Look forward to talking
Thank
to you again. Take care. Bye-bye. So this is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks very much for listening.